Chapter 7. Clean through and through the poor animal's chest without quite killing him. When he heard all this, he turned as pale as if the missing man had been his own dear brother or father, and shivered and shook all over, as if he had had a fit of the ague. At first he was too much overpowered with grief to be able to do anything at all, or to concert upon any plan of action, so that for a long time he endeavored to dissuade Mr. Shuttleworthy's other friends from making a stir about the matter, thinking it best to wait a while, say for a week or two, or a month, or two, to see if something wouldn't turn up, or if Mr. Shuttleworthy wouldn't come in the natural way, and explain his reasons for sending his horse on before. I dare say you have often observed this disposition to temporize, or to procrastinate, in people who are laboring under any very poignant sorrow. Their powers of mind seem to be rendered torpid, so that they have a horror of anything like action, and like nothing in the world so well, as to lie quietly in bed and nurse their grief, as the old ladies express it, that is to say, ruminate over the trouble. The people of Rattleboro had, indeed, so high an opinion of the wisdom and discretion of L.D. Charlie, that the greater part of them felt disposed to agree with him, and not make a stir in the business till something should turn up, as the honest old gentleman worded it, and I believe that, after all, this would have been the general determination, but for the very suspicious interference of Mr. Shuttleworthy's nephew, a young man of very dissipated habits, and otherwise of rather bad character. This nephew, whose name was Pennifeather, would listen to nothing like reason in the matter of being quiet, but insisted upon making immediate search for the corpse of the murdered man. This was the expression he employed. And Mr. Goodfellow acutely remarked at the time that it was singular expression, to say no more. This remark of old Charlie's, apostrophe to, had great effect upon the crowd, and one of the party was heard to ask, very impressively, how it happened that young Mr. Pennifeather was so intimately cognizant of all the circumstances connected with his wealthy uncle's disappearance, as to feel authorized to assert, distinctly and unequivocally, that his uncle was a murdered man. Apostrophe hereupon some little squibbing and bickering occurred among various members of the crowd, and especially between L.D. Charlie and Mr. Pennifeather, although this latter occurrence was, indeed, by no means a novelty, for no goodwill had subsisted between the parties for the last 3 or 4 months. And matters had even gone so far that Mr. Pennifeather had actually knocked down his uncle's friend for some alleged excess of liberty that the latter had taken in the uncle's house, of which the nephew was an inmate. Upon this occasion, L.D. Charlie is said to have behaved with exemplary moderation and Christian charity. He arose from the blow, adjusted his clothes, and made no attempt at retaliation at all, merely muttering a few words about aching summary vengeance at the first convenient opportunity, a natural and very justifiable ebullition of anger, which meant nothing, however, and, beyond doubt, was no sooner given vent to than forgotten. However these matters may be which have no reference to the point now at issue, it is quite certain that the people of Rattleboro, principally through the persuasion of Mr. Pennifeather, came at length to the determination of dispersion over the adjacent country in search of the missing Mr. Shuttleworthy. I say they came to this determination in the first instance. After it had been fully resolved that a search should be made, it was considered almost a matter of course that the seekers should disperse, that is to say, distribute themselves in parties for the more thorough examination of the region round about. I forget, however, by what ingenious train of reasoning it was that L.D. Charlie finally convinced the assembly that this was the most injudicious plan that could be pursued. Convince them, however, he did all except Mr. Pennifeather, and, in the end, it was arranged that a search should be instituted, carefully and very thoroughly, by the burghers en masse, old Charlie himself leading the way. As for the matter of that, there could have been no better pioneer than old Charlie, whom everybody knew to have the eye of a lynx. But, although he let them into all manner of out-of-the-way holes and corners, by routes that nobody had ever suspected of existing in the neighborhood. And although the search was incessantly kept up day and night for nearly a week, still no trace of Mr. Shuttleworthy could be discovered. When I say no trace, however, I must not be understood to speak literally, for trace, to some extent, there certainly was. The poor gentleman had been tracked, by his horse's shoes, which were peculiar, to a spot about 3 miles to the east of the borough, on the main road leading to the city. Here the track made off into a bypath through a piece of woodland, the path coming out again into the main road, and cutting off about half a mile of the regular distance. Following the shoe marks down this lane, the party came at length to a pool of stagnant water, half hidden by the brambles, to the right of the lane, and opposite this pool all vestige of the track was lost sight of. It appeared, however, that a struggle of some nature had here taken place, and it seemed as if some large and heavy body, much larger and heavier than a man, had been drawn from the bypath to the pool. This ladder was carefully dragged twice, but nothing was found, and the party was upon the point of going away, in despair of coming to any result, when Providence suggested to Mr. Goodfellow the expediency of draining the water off altogether. This project was received with cheers, and many high compliments, to L.D. Charlie upon his sagacity and consideration. As many of the burghers had brought spades with them, supposing that they might possibly be called upon to disinter a corpse, the drain was easily and speedily effected. And no sooner was the bottom visible, than right in the middle of the mud that remained was discovered a black silk velvet waistcoat, which nearly everyone present immediately recognized as the property of Mr. Pennifeather. This waistcoat was much torn and stained with blood, and there were several persons among the party who had a distinct remembrance of its having been worn by its owner on the very morning of Mr. Shuttleworthy's departure for the city, while there were others, again, ready to testify upon oath, if required, that Mr. P. did not wear the garment in question at any period during the remainder of that memorable day, nor could anyone be found to say that he had seen it upon Mr. P.'s person at any period at all subsequent to Mr. Shuttleworthy's disappearance. Matters now wore a very serious aspect for Mr. Pennifeather, and it was observed, as an indubitable confirmation of the suspicions which were excited against him, that he grew exceedingly pale, and when asked what he had to say for himself, was utterly incapable of saying a word. Hereupon, the few friends his riotous mode of living had left him, deserted him at once to a man, and were even more clamorous than his ancient and avowed enemies for his instantaneous arrest. But, on the other hand, the magnanimity of Mr. Goodfellow shone forth with only the more brilliant luster through contrast. He made a warm and intensely eloquent defense of Mr. Pennifeather, in which he alluded more than once to his own sincere forgiveness of that wild young gentleman, the heir of the worthy Mr. Shuttleworthy, for the insult which he, the young gentleman, had, no doubt in the heat of passion, thought proper to put upon him. Mr. Goodfellow, he forgave him for it, he said, from the very bottom of his heart. And for himself, Mr. Goodfellow, so far from pushing the suspicious circumstances to extremity, which he was sorry to say, really had arisen against Mr. Pennifeather, he, Mr. Goodfellow, would make every exertion in his power, would employ all the little eloquence in his possession to soften down, as much as he could conscientiously do so, the worst features of this really exceedingly perplexing piece of business. Mr. Goodfellow went on for some half hour longer in this strain, very much to the credit both of his head and of his heart. But dear warm-hearted people are seldom apposite in their observations. They run into all sorts of blunders, contretemps and malapropos-isms, in the hot-headedness of their zeal, to serve a friend thus, often with the kindest intentions in the world, doing infinitely more to prejudice his cause than to advance it. So, in the present instance, it turned out with all the eloquence of L.D. Charlie, for, although he labored earnestly in behalf of the suspected, yet it so happened, somehow or other, that every syllable he uttered of which the direct, but unwitting tendency was not to exalt the speaker in the good opinion of his audience, had the effect to deepen the suspicion already attached to the individual whose cause he pleaded, and to arouse against him the fury of the mob. One of the most unaccountable errors committed by the orator was his allusion to the suspected as the heir of the worthy old gentleman Mr. Shuttleworthy. The people had really never thought of this before. They had only remembered certain threats of disinheritance uttered a year or two previously by the uncle who had no living relative except the nephew, and they had, therefore, always looked upon this disinheritance as a matter that was settled so single-minded a race of beings were the Rattleburgers. But the remark of L.D. Charlie brought them at once to a consideration of this point, and thus gave them to see the possibility of the threats having been nothing more than a threat. And straightway hereupon arose the natural question of Cubic I Bono, a question that tended even more than the waistcoat to fasten the terrible crime upon the young man. And here, lest I may be misunderstood, permit me to digress for one moment merely to observe that the exceedingly brief and simple Latin phrase which I have employed is invariably mistranslated and misconceived. See cui bono? In all the crack novels and elsewhere, in those of Mrs. Gore, for example, the author of Esel, a lady who quotes all tongues from the Chaldean to Chickasaw, and is helped to her learning, as needed, upon a systematic plan, by Mr. Beckford. In all the crack novels, I say, from those of Bulwer and Dickens to those of Bulwer and Dickens to those of Turnapenny and Ainsworth, the two little Latin words cubic I bono are rendered, oh what purpose, or, as if quo bono, to what good. Their true meaning, nevertheless, is or whose advantage. Cui, to whom, bono, is it for a benefit? It is a purely legal phrase, and applicable precisely in cases such as we have now under consideration, where the probability of the doer of a deed hinges upon the probability of the benefit accruing to this individual, or to that from the deed's accomplishment. Now in the present instance, the question cubic I bono very pointedly implicated Mr. Pennifeather. His uncle had threatened him, after making a will in his favor, with disinheritance. But the threat had not been actually kept. The original will, it appeared, had not been altered. Had it been altered, the only supposable motive for murder on the part of the suspected would have been the ordinary one of revenge. And even this would have been counteracted by the hope of reinstation into the good graces of the uncle. But the will being unaltered, while the threat to alter remained suspended over the nephew's head, there appears at once the very strongest possible inducement for the atrocity, and so concluded, very sagaciously, the worthy citizens of the borough of Rattle. Mr. Pennifeather was, accordingly, arrested upon the spot, and the crowd, after some further search, proceeded homeward, having him in custody. On the route, however, another circumstance occurred tending to confirm the suspicion entertained. Mr. Goodfellow, whose zeal led him to be always a little in advance of the party, was seen suddenly to run forward a few paces, stoop, and then apparently to pick up some small object from the grass. Having quickly examined it, he was observed to make a sort of half attempt at concealing it in his coat pocket. But this action was noticed, as I say, and consequently prevented, when the object picked up was found to be a Spanish knife which a dozen persons at once recognized as belonging to Mr. Pennifeather. Moreover, his initials were engraved upon the handle. The blade of this knife was open and bloody. No doubt now remained of the guilt of the nephew, and immediately upon reaching Rattleboro he was taken before a magistrate for examination. Here matters again took a most unfavorable turn. The prisoner, being questioned as to his whereabouts on the morning of Mr. Shuttleworthy's disappearance, had absolutely the audacity to acknowledge that on that very morning he had been out with his rifle deer stalking in the immediate neighborhood of the pool where the blood-stained waistcoat had been discovered through the sagacity of Mr. Goodfellow. This latter now came forward and, with tears in his eyes, asked permission to be examined. He said that a stern sense of the duty he owed his maker, not less than his fellow men, would permit him no longer to remain silent. Hitherto, the sincerest affection for the young man, notwithstanding the latter's ill treatment of himself, Mr. Goodfellow, had induced him to make every hypothesis which imagination could suggest, by way of endeavoring to account for what appeared suspicious in the circumstances that told so seriously against Mr. Pennifeather. But these circumstances were now altogether too convincing, too damning. He would hesitate no longer. He would tell all he knew, although his heart, Mr. Goodfellow's, should absolutely burst asunder in the effort. He then went on to state that, on the afternoon of the day previous to Mr. Shuttleworthy's departure for the city, that worthy old gentleman had mentioned to his nephew, in his hearing, Mr. Goodfellow's, that his object in going to town on the morrow was to make a deposit of an unusually large sum of money in the Armors and Mechanics Bank, and that, then and there, the said Mr. Shuttleworthy had distinctly avowed to the said nephew his irrevocable determination of rescinding the will originally made, and of cutting him off with a shilling. He, the witness, now solemnly called upon the accused to state whether what he, the witness, had just stated was or was not the truth in every substantial particular. Much to the astonishment of everyone present, Mr. Pennifeather frankly admitted that it was. The magistrate now considered it his duty to send a couple of constables to search the chamber of the accused in the house of his uncle. From this search they almost immediately returned with the well-known steel-bound, russet leather pocketbook which the old gentleman had been in the habit of carrying for years. Its valuable contents, however, had been abstracted, and the magistrate in vain endeavored to extort from the prisoner the use which had been made of them, or the place of their concealment. Indeed, he obstinately denied all knowledge of the matter. The constables, also, discovered, between the bed and sacking of the unhappy man, a shirt and neck handkerchief both marked with the initials of his name, and both hideously besmeared with the blood of the victim. At this juncture, it was announced that the horse of the murdered man had just expired in the stable from the effects of the wound he had received, and it was proposed by Mr. Goodfellow that a post-mortem examination of the beast should be immediately made, with the view, if possible, of discovering the ball. This was accordingly done, and, as if to demonstrate beyond a question the guilt of the accused, Mr. Goodfellow, after considerable searching in the cavity of the chest, was enabled to detect and to pull forth a bullet of very extraordinary size, which, upon trial, was found to be exactly adapted to the bore of Mr. Pennifeather's rifle, while it was far too large for that of any other person in the borough or its vicinity. To render the matter even surer yet, however, this bullet was discovered to have a flaw or seam at right angles to the usual suture, and upon examination, this seam corresponded precisely with an accidental ridge or elevation in a pair of molds acknowledged by the accused himself to be his own property. Upon finding of this bullet, the examining magistrate refused to listen to any farther testimony, and immediately committed the prisoner for trial, declining resolutely to take any bail in the case, although against this severity Mr. Goodfellow very warmly remonstrated, and offered to become surety in whatever amount might be required. This generosity on the part of L.D. Charlie was only in accordance with the whole tenor of his amiable and chivalrous conduct during the entire period of his sojourn in the borough of Rattle. In the present instance, the worthy man was so entirely carried away by the excessive warmth of his sympathy that he seemed to have quite forgotten, when he offered to go bail for his young friend, that he himself, Mr. Goodfellow, did not possess a single dollar's worth of property upon the face of the earth. The result of the committal may be readily foreseen. Mr. Pennifeather, amid the loud execrations of all Rattleboro, was brought to trial at the next criminal sessions, when the chain of circumstantial evidence, strengthened as it was by some additional damning facts, which Mr. Goodfellow's sensitive conscientiousness forbade him to withhold from the court, was considered so unbroken, and so thoroughly conclusive, that the jury, without leaving their seats, returned an immediate verdict of guilty of murder in the first degree. Soon afterward the unhappy wretch received sentence of death, and was remanded to the county jail to await the inexorable vengeance of the law. In the meantime, the noble behavior of L.D. Charlie Goodfellow had doubly endeared him to the honest citizens of the borough. He became 10 times a greater favorite than ever, and, as a natural result of the hospitality with which he was treated, he relaxed, as it were, perforce, the extremely parsimonious habits which his poverty had hitherto impelled him to observe, and very frequently had little reunions at his own house, when wit and jollity reigned supreme, dampened a little, of course, by the occasional remembrance of the untoward and melancholy fate which impended over the nephew of the late lamented bosom friend of the generous host. One fine day, this magnanimous old gentleman was agreeably surprised at the receipt of the following letter. Charles Goodfellow Esquire, Rattleboro from H. F.F. B. and Company Chat. Mar. A number. 1. 6 dozen bottles, 1-2 gross. The above inscription lies vertically to the left of the following letter in the print version ed. Charles Goodfellow Esquire. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.